Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. A former Utah governor calls out President Trump for his post about the death of director Rob Reiner. Mike Lee eyes national park sites in the latest push on public lands. And in Utah, Pam Bondi put a stop to a surgeon's vaccine fraud trial and ignited nationwide hope for more medical freedom pardons. Later in the program, we'll be talking with investigative reporter Jessica Strifles. This part of the program, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Hey, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. We also have with us water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thank you.
Yeah, happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Well, let's start with you, Robert. This is something that made national news. I guess, first of all, start at the beginning. Robert, famous director Rob Reiner and his wife were tragically murdered.
Yeah. They were found stabbed to death in their home just outside of Los Angeles, in the LA area, at least. And their son, who'd had a history of drug abuse issues, was arrested on suspicion of murder. Rob Reiner, for those who don't know him, I think everybody knows his films, you know, When Harry Met Sally, Princess Bride, Stand By Me, A Few Good Men. Yes, he's a prolific and much admired director, and their deaths were tragic, and I think most people responded accordingly. President Trump went on Truth Social and said that the reason that they were murdered was because of Trump derangement syndrome. He said that, I'll read a portion of it. He said that their deaths were reportedly due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding, and incurable affliction with a mind-crippling disease known as Trump derangement syndrome. And I think this was pretty uniformly seen as a disgusting tweet. There was an event sponsored by the Republican Party mainly for donors and some office holders that featured former Governor Mike Leavitt, former Governor Gary Herbert, and Governor Spencer Cox. And during this event, Governor Herbert was pretty pointed in his criticism of that particular social media post. He said, is there not any ability for compassion and grace and respect under a difficult circumstance? He went on to say, quote, we're on a pathway of division and divisiveness that we ought not to be on. We as Republicans need to say, let's hold our candidates to a higher standard. Same with Democrats. Let's have some grace and compassion and mutual respect. We're all God's children. And that drew a pretty rousing round of applause from those people in attendance, even though, like I said, it was pointed at the party's president.
Yeah, we should note that this particular comment from President Trump was criticized by some Republicans nationwide as well.
Nationwide, yeah, there were. I can't say how many, but there were a significant number of Republicans who saw this as an offensive tweet, kind of beneath the dignity. And it also sort of, many people contrasted it with after Charlie Kirk was murdered down in Orem, there were a lot of people who were outraged by anybody who would criticize Charlie Kirk. And in this instance, you've got the President of the United States, being the leading critic and making it about him and pointing the finger at Rob Reiner, who, by the way, when Charlie Kirk was murdered, said, you know, he disagreed with Charlie Kirk's political views, but he did not deserve to be murdered. So, you know, it's a pretty stark contrast. A lot of Republicans distanced themselves from that. Governor Herbert in particular was critical of him. He was also critical, it's probably worth noting, of the way that Donald Trump treated Nikki Haley, who was the governor of South Carolina at the same time Governor Herbert was in office. And when Nikki Haley ran for president, President Trump repeatedly referred to her as bird brain. That was the nickname he gave her. And Governor Herbert said about that in particular, he said, she's a smart lady. Why do we tolerate that? And so, you know, and it fits this theme. Governor Spencer Cox has talked repeatedly about disagree better and toning down our rhetoric and so forth. You remember that Governor Cox endorsed President Trump after somebody tried to kill President Trump at a rally in Pennsylvania, because according to Governor Cox at the time, he said he thought President Trump could rise to the challenge of unifying the country. And he has said since that he's hasn't seen that from the president. And it's comes through in social media posts like this.
What did former Governor Leavitt say?
Afterwards we asked Governor Leavitt, what he thought of not specifically, we didn't ask him specifically about this social media post, but just sort of the tone and tenor of our political discourse generally. And he said, I'll quote him again, "There's a divisiveness of polarization that it is intuitively not healthy. And it's important that as a country, we find our way into the sense of harmony that's allowed us to become and remain a strong global power that is exceptional." So all three of them kind of sounded this common theme of this rhetoric in our country, the political rhetoric, our discourse is toxic and it's not healthy. And we need to try to show a little grace to our fellow Americans.
As you mentioned, Governor Cox is, I guess he has a program, he has a plan that he's trying to push this disagree better, something he's actually trying to accomplish with the disagree better.
Yeah, he's been having forums, meetings, panels, that sort of thing, appearances with Democratic governors, fellow Democratic governors, and sort of stressing this need he believes that we need to tone down our the caustic rhetoric and not engage in personal attacks. We can disagree politically about policy issues, but we shouldn't attack, demonize, belittle, dehumanize the opposition. So for Governor Cox in particular, and Governor Herbert during this panel, acknowledged, recognized, and praised Governor Cox for those efforts. And they also talked about the way he responded to after the Charlie Kirk assassination, and sort of he got some national attention for his response to that. So this has been an ongoing thing for Governor Cox. But again, when the head of the party is posting social media posts like this one, and this is obviously not isolated. He's got a long track record of posting personal attacks on his political rivals or enemies. It's a little bit hard for a governor from Utah to sort of counteract that.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. We have a little bit of time. I'd like to go to, seems like Robert, we about every week when we're talking about redistricting, this is ongoing. I'd like to
This
reach back to
saga
a
that
story
never ends.
from last week. Republican lawmakers have pushed the deadline out for Utahns to register for 2026 congressional races. This appears to be in part to give them a little bit of time to appeal the judge's decision in the redistricting case. What's the latest here?
So as it stands right now, the register the candidate, well, as it stood before the special session, the candidate filing period for congressional seats opened on January 2nd. And because of that, there were all these things that county clerks needed to do to make sure the precincts were set up and so forth. And so that made the deadline to get a map in place November 10th. As we've talked about on the program before, November 10th was when Judge Diana Gibson issued a ruling that said that said that the map the legislature sent her was no good, and she picked a different map that had been submitted by the plaintiffs that creates this Democratic leaning district, I should say, in the northern part of Salt Lake County. Obviously, the legislature's furious about that, outraged about that ruling. They moved the deadlines to March, which is where they had been in the past, but they moved it back to March just for congressional candidates. If you're running for, state legislature or so forth, your filing deadline's still in January, but they moved it back for congressional candidates to March to give themselves a little bit of a window to appeal. Now, they haven't appealed yet. And one of the things that has happened this week is that they are asking the judge to issue a final ruling. There's still a lot of issues related to this redistricting litigation that are pending that they think should be resolved now because the judge ruled on this central core piece. And they want a final ruling in this case so they can appeal this to the Utah Supreme Court or potentially to the US Supreme Court. The plaintiffs in the case, League of Women Voters and Women for Ethical Government, had a court filing this week that said basically, they can file their appeal whenever they want to file their appeal. They don't need a final ruling. These other issues are still they're still active issues that need to potentially be litigated. They don't want to waive their right to litigate those if need be. And they said that actually there's an interesting potential, I guess I should say, that the legislative defendants have missed their deadline to file an appeal. So the judges asked for some briefing, some briefs on that, and plans to decide on that issue. But as of now, even though the legislature has moved the deadlines, we're still kind of waiting and watching for them to actually file that appeal that they have said that they intend to do. So that's kind of where it stands right now. We're expecting, I believe, sometime next week, the judge is going to get those briefs from both parties on the issue of whether she needs to issue a final ruling before they can appeal, and presumably, the legislature will file that appeal, but as I said, they haven't yet.
So, if this map holds that the judge
Yeah.
picked, we estimate some 17% advantage for Democrats. That predictably means a lot of Democrats want to run for this. That seems like a new one is popping up every week.
State Senator Kathleen Reby from Cottonwood Heights was sort of the first one that jumped in. The next day, former Congressman Ben McAdams, his former Salt Lake mayor, got into the race. State Senator Nate Bluhin is in the race. Former State Senator and Salt Lake City Councilman Derek Kitchen is in the race. This week, Ava Lopez Chavez announced that she was getting into the race. We anticipate there may be others still too. This is just kind of, I think, shows that, there's been this bottleneck or blockade or blockage in for Democrats who want to run for a seat like this, because before now all of the seats had been safely Republican seats. Now there's this window of opportunity, and there is no shortage of people who are vying for that. So could make for a very interesting primary next summer, and we'll see who else maybe gets in. Caroline Gleick, who was a Senate candidate last year against John Curtis, is said that she's considering it as well, and there are likely to be potentially others too.
One more related topic on this, Robert. The Republicans in the legislature are not happy with the courts. That's an understatement. With the legislative session upcoming, any rumblings of further action? I think they did expand. Did that pass? They expanded the Supreme Court. Any
No,
rumblings about?
they haven't expanded the
Oh,
Supreme
they haven't
Court
done that
yet.
yet. Okay.
But I do have a story that was going to run this week, but we're holding it because of the holidays, about that prospect for expansion. Governor Cox has said that he thinks it's a good idea. Last year, Speaker Schultz was sort of a big proponent of adding two justices to the Supreme Court. Not to give people too much of a sneak preview of what's to come, but the governor included $2.8 million in his budget proposal to add two justices to the Supreme Court and two judges to the Court of Appeals. Their argument is that Utah is a growing state, and it doesn't make sense in their eyes to have the same number of justices that we had when there were only about 1 million people living here. We're up over 3.3 now, obviously. And they think that adding justices will make it more efficient. In my story, I spoke to recently retired Justice Associate Chief Justice John Pierce, who told me that if you're looking to make the court more efficient, adding justices is the completely wrong answer. Because he said, if you go from having needing three votes on the court, three of the five justices to support an opinion to having to get four, that means you're going to have to do more edits to your opinions. It's going to take more time to write it. You need to get more input from the different justices. And it's actually going to slow them down. Plus, he says that they don't have a backlog at the Supreme Court level. The backlogs right now are at the district court level, the appellate court level, and also just because, from what he said, the attorney general's office doesn't have the resources to get cases briefed and ready to be heard by the Supreme Court. So he said they're hearing cases once they're briefed, but it's those intermittent steps or intermediate steps that are taking more time and causing delays that, he said if the legislature wants to address those, that would be helpful.
Well, I'm sure you'll be on this. You will see that story, I guess, after the holidays. And
Yeah.
Robert, thanks for telling us all about these.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Here's the headline: Mike Lee eyes national park sites and the latest push on public lands. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thanks for joining us.
Hello, so
Hello.
excited to talk to you about national parks.
So national parks again, and Senator Lee, he's at it again. Maybe some background. We talked to you, I think, Leah, a while back. Senator Lee was trying to put a provision in the Big Beautiful Bill, right? What was he trying to do there?
Yeah, I'm sure your listeners are well aware of this, but back in the spring and summer when Congress was trying to push through President Trump's one big beautiful bill, Senator Mike Lee, our representative from Utah, tried to push through this provision that would have sold off some portion of public lands. I think it started out first being Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management lands, but then it kind of got pared back to just being BLM lands. Ostensibly, he wanted to sell these like parcels near communities that, according to him, weren't highly used. They're not beloved trails or parks or things, but just these parcels that are owned by the federal government, near communities. And he thought they would be a great source of land to build affordable housing, which is much needed throughout the West. That was what he put forth, and it was met with immediate and pretty intense backlash, including among his own base. There was a point in time, I think, when you would go on what's formerly Twitter, but now X, and just the senator was just getting dunked on by conservatives over this and just like really ridiculed and raked through the coals over this proposal. So he ended up pulling it back, blaming it not on the backlash, but on kind of a procedural issue with the Senate parliamentarians. That it wasn't like he hadn't dotted his I's and crossed his T's procedurally. So he ended up pulling it back and saying he was going to work on it and bring back something better. But he never really did, and the bill passed without that. And we all moved on, but we're kind of looking over his shoulder, wondering what he might do next. And it seems like this latest amendment he's putting forth is his next push.
So what with this latest amendment, what would that do?
So this latest amendment dropped this week, and it involves this package of spending bills, not as big as the One Big Beautiful Bill, which was like they call it an omnibus spending bill. This is more called a minibus bill, bunch of bills, which have to do with spending. But some of it involves the Interior Department, and this amendment he put forth is very short, very brief, but all it really does is appeal a small section in this interior spending bill. And this section is only a sentence long, but because we're talking about federal legislation, it's kind of a long, meandering, verbose sentence. But basically, in summary, what the sentence says is that national park units are federal lands run by federal employees. So he wants to repeal that. And you might wonder, well, why would that be? I mean, does he want national parks to be run by private vendors? Like, what's the aim here? But reading between the lines, what a lot of like national park advocates and public land advocates are worried about is that earlier this year, when all the debates were going on about the One Big Beautiful Bill, and when the Trump administration had put forward their budget proposal, what they had sneaked into to the portion dealing with national parks is that they would like to take some of these smaller park units with lower visitation, mostly local visitation, and hand them back to states to manage and I guess own. So if you think about it, in Utah, we're lucky to have all these beautiful, huge national parks that we all know and love. The Mighty Five is what the state's branded them, but your Capitol Reef, your Zion, your Arches. We have those. Everybody knows those. But what your listeners may not be aware of is we have a bunch of smaller units too. Golden Spike would be a great example up here in northern Utah, kind of remote, out of the way. But if you're on your way to Spiral Jetty, you'll probably stop by Golden Spike and look at the cool little trains and the museum they have there when the Transcontinental Railroad came together. So that's a national park unit, not a national park itself. It's called a historical park. There's Cedars Breaks down by Cedar City and Brian Head. That's not a national park, it's a national monument. We have like the Mormon Pioneer National Trail, not a park, but still a national park unit. So they're all over the state, they're all over the nation, but they're smaller. They don't get as much visitation, they don't get quite the marketing push that our Mighty Five do. But these seem to be the units that are sort of in the federal government's crosshairs. And this push by Mike Lee, or this amendment that he put forth, is perhaps a way of keeping the door open to unload these little parks from the federal government and hand them off to the states. Maybe we'll see.
What is this amendment getting the same reaction, as, especially from conservative circles, as the previous one?
It's so new. It just came out this week, so we'll see. I guess we'll see. I talked to hunters and anglers lobbying group, and they're not happy about it, which was part of the conservative base that rose up against Lee with the first push. When you think about national parks, hunting's not really allowed in Arches or Canyonlands, but there are certain units where it is allowed, in national reserves, which I didn't know until I talked to this lobbying group. I'm not a hunter myself, but there are certain park units where you can hunt. So Craters of the Moon National Reserve would be a good example up in Idaho. You can hunt on that during certain times of the year. So this does impact hunters and anglers. So they're not stoked about it. And I just think the whole idea of selling off these national treasures that's just beloved just for their historical recreation, natural values, the sense of national pride, I think it just isn't unsettling to a lot of people. Even with Mike Lee's first push, he was constantly articulating it as, I'm just trying to offload these lands that nobody's using anyway. They're just like these parcels, these BLM parcels in the middle of like near a city like Cedar City that, people just dump their mattresses on or something, where no one's trying to touch the national parks. We would never do that. And that's what the messaging you constantly heard. But I think people are maybe a little stunned that maybe national parks aren't off the table.
So we don't know what the end game might be, right, with this. I guess the state control, maybe privatizing some of these, but what are and state leaders, you note in the story, state leaders have long wanted more control. What are they saying about this particular proposal?
Yeah, it's true. State leaders have long, Utahns know this. It's just been like for decades, this has been the push. Utah wants some control of federal lands. Like 65% of the state is federal lands, not state lands. It's lands that the federal government tells us how we can use them, whether we can mine them, whether we can graze on them, whether we're going to protect them in perpetuity as a park. It's kind of managed by the federal government, and the state doesn't always like that. The state thinks, local people who are more familiar with these lands would better manage them. So there's been this long-standing push to take over Bureau of Land Management lands, Forest Service lands, but national parks are always off the table. That was always the messaging, like, we don't want the parks, we wouldn't touch the parks. So when I went to the state, because we reached out to Mike Lee's office, of course, to get more clarity on like, hey, what are you doing? What's your intention behind this? Is it as bad as some of these, advocacy groups are worried about, and they didn't respond to us. So I was just wondering if maybe he's coordinating with state agencies. So I reached out to the Department of Natural Resources. And then what I initially heard is that, they hadn't heard anything like that, that no one's trying to go after national parks. But I guess we'll see. We'll see.
In the meantime, this minibus, this a collection of spending bills, where does that stand right now?
So it's getting debated over pretty ferociously in the Senate right now. Could get a vote by the end of the end of today, I guess, but it seems like that's not likely, especially with this Lee thing popping up. But they do want to vote on it by the end of January, I believe, but it ha also has yet to go through the House, so it still has, a pretty steep uphill battle before it's all approved and signed off on.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. We're talking with Leah Larson, Salt Lake Tribune. I want to get in this story. Looks like we have a little bit of time for this. Here's the headline: A fast-growing Utah city isn't ready for nuclear power, at least not yet. We're talking about Eagle Mountain. So Eagle Mountain is kind of an interesting place, Utah County, right? And there is fast-growing, but kind of a bedroom community, right? One of the things they want to do is bring in industry.
I think this is the story with a lot of these rapidly growing communities where a bunch of houses went up, a bunch of rooftops, a bunch of people moved in, but there's not really any businesses yet. They haven't caught up. So the city, as it's trying to provide services for all these new residents and rapidly growing communities, they don't have the tax base. So what Eagle Mountain did pretty early on is welcome in data centers. There's a sprawling Meta campus, data center campus in Eagle Mountain, which your listeners might be familiar with. So that provides like some degree of tax revenue to help them pay for city services. But as we all know, data centers, especially with the rise of artificial intelligence, you suck a lot of energy, a lot of water and a lot of energy. So Eagle Mountain is thinking about its future and what it's going to do next. It still has its door, the welcome mat out for data centers and more data centers. They're wondering, like, how are we going to power these things? And so early this year, this discussion popped up where maybe we should create an energy corridor zone, create an ordinance creating this energy corridor zone where we don't know quite what energy will be there, but we do know what we don't want. We don't want coal. We don't want hydropower, which makes sense, or no rivers or streams to create hydropower in Eagle Mountain. And they don't want wind. Just those turbines are kind of unsightly. So what they are open to though is solar. They're open to geothermal, and the thing that really got everybody's attention is they're open to nuclear. So that is what has been the source of many debates and I think many fights in that community for the last year is whether or not Eagle Mountain's going to open the door to nuclear in its backyard.
What are the objections to nuclear? What or a caution, I guess. What are they thinking about?
Well, I think they'll be of no surprise to anybody, but the same things we've heard since nuclear ever arrived on the scene, like safety. What are radioactive waste is dangerous. So, the Wasatch Front is on a huge earthquake fault. So, if you build a nuclear reactor, what happens if there's an earthquake? What are you going to do with all the waste? We were supposed to, in the 80s, we decided we were going to send it all to Yucca Mountain in Nevada, and that's off the table. Nevada doesn't want it. So the reactors that we do have, the power plants that we do have, are just storing their waste on site. And that's kind of unsettling to a lot of people to know that not only do you have a generator in your backyard, but the waste is just kind of piling up and piling up. And it takes, of course, thousands of years for radioactive material to degrade and not be radioactive anymore. So it's a pretty generational commitment that you're making. So I think that's kind of the summary of concerns that are not surprising necessarily.
One thing that stood out to me here, this Eagle Mountain, along with some of these fast-growing communities on the west side, Eagle Mountain does have a problem with water, I think, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, all of Utah has a problem with water, but particularly this west side of the Salt Lake Valley, Utah Valley, they don't have like the big Wasatch Mountains that the east side has, where you get streams and snowpack runoff. It's pretty dry out there. They're pretty heavily reliant on groundwater. groundwater is a pretty finite resource, and it's hard to track and see what are we overtapping it until it's too late. They also buy some water from the Central Utah Water District, but water is foremost concern to them, and most energy projects take a lot of water, so that of course is a concern too. Nuclear traditionally uses water, although there's been all these technological advances where people claim now that this doesn't use nearly as much water as it used to. But I think that has yet to be really be seen and proven because it's so new. Especially what they're proposing out in Eagle Mountain is not really necessarily these huge nuclear plants like you see on The Simpsons or whatever. It's more these things that call small modular reactors, which are, as a name would suggest, a lot smaller. But these technologies are very new. I think there's one ever that's been built in China or something, or Russia, and not in the United States. There's some experiments going on, but the technology hasn't been proven. It's also very expensive. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. They're grappling with this. And as you said, these are issues that not only Eagle Mountain's dealing with, right? Many others are dealing with these issues. Leah Larson, thanks for telling us about this.
You bet.
Well, our last interview is recorded, so we're going to go to our underplayed stories of the week right now. Robert Gerke, what's your underplayed story?
So this is an ongoing issue and one that Leah knows very well, but there's a big meeting, there was a big meeting in Las Vegas this week to negotiate the future of the Colorado River, obviously. We know the upper basin states and lower basin states, Utah being an upper basin state, are at a bit of a impasse over how much water each should get going forward. They're trying to negotiate a new settlement. The federal government's putting a little bit of pressure on the states to come to an agreement because obviously the 40 million people rely on Colorado River for their water, main water source. And so this is an important issue that I think is going to shape the future of the West. And so it's worth watching. And we had a report of Brooke Larson there, and you can read about her report at sltrib.com.
All right, sltrib.com for that. Leah Larson, what's your underplayed story?
Mine was by my colleague Peyton Harkins. It's about this cute, stunning, beautiful shop here in Ogden called True Tone. And what they do is sell incandescent holiday bulbs. So this is a great holiday story, perfect time of year for this. And it's just it'll give you all the warm and fuzzies. It's like a great read. And if you ever are in Ogden, I suggest that you drive up 26th Street and just see the storefront. It is so adorable, so cute. It's like very vintage, and it's a throwback to the holly decorations of the 60s, and they do such a good job. So check that out and look at the beautiful photos, and it's a really fun story.
You can find that at sltrib.com as well. Well, we've been talking with politics reporter Robert Gerke. Thanks so much, Robert.
Yeah, thanks, Don. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. And we've also been talking with the water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Thanks, Leah.
You're welcome. Take care.
Take care. Happy holidays. The program continues following a break. We're going to talk with Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Schreifels. Here's the headline. In Utah, Pam Bondi put a stop to a surgeon's vaccine fraud trial and ignited nationwide hope for more medical freedom pardons. We'll have that story following the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams, and we turn next to Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Streifels. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a very interesting story. Just a couple of days ago here, you published a connection with ProPublica, right?
Yep, that's right.
So here's the headline. In Utah, Pam Bondi put a stop to a surgeon's vaccine fraud trial and ignited nationwide hope for more medical freedom pardons. This gets right into a movement, right? Medical freedom. So first of all, tell me who this doctor is, and what was he accused of doing?
Yes, so Dr. Kirk Moore owns a plastic surgery clinic in Midvale, and During the pandemic, he was one of the healthcare providers who signed up to give COVID-19 vaccines out to Utahns. But he does not believe that the vaccine is safe, didn't want it for himself, and didn't think his patients needed it. And so he signed up for the program essentially to falsify COVID-19 vaccination cards, like fill them out as if his patient had been vaccinated, but then he just threw away the dose. The patient never got the shot. And so he said he did that because of patient choice, because this was, as you might remember, there was vaccine card mandates for a certain period of time. You couldn't go into certain businesses or, be in the military, things like that, without proof that you had gotten a COVID-19 vaccination. So he did that in order to have some people have the card so they could get access where they wanted to be, but without actually being vaccinated.
So he also is accused of, I guess, injecting children with saline solution. He says at the behest of their parents.
Yes, that's right. And so sometimes there would be parents who didn't, who came in for the fake COVID card, and they'd bring their kids as well. And Dr. Moore said that he or his office staff would give them a saline shot, the children, and sometimes the parents too, so that the children would believe that they were vaccinated even though they hadn't been.
So what was he accused, what were the charges, I guess?
Right, so he was charged in federal court a couple years ago. The main charges were attempting to defraud the federal government or deceive the government. And so he faced, I forget the exact number of charges, but he was facing up to 35 years in prison on these charges. So they were pretty hefty, and they were all connected to this practice he was doing of giving out these fake COVID cards without ever vaccinating anyone.
So this was a case brought under the Biden administration, I guess. So the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, what did she do and what did she say?
So Dr. Moore went to trial on this case in July, just a couple months ago, earlier this year. And, they had this big rally before the trial started, and a whole week of testimony had gone by. And then that Saturday, AG Pam Bondi announced that she was ordering the prosecutors in Utah to drop the case, and that Dr. Moore gave his patients a choice and he shouldn't face prison. And that's essentially what happened. The prosecutors dropped the case here, and Dr. Moore was able to walk away without any charges or any convictions. The case just kind of went away.
There's a picture, a photo of the doctor, Dr. Moore, with the Attorney General and with Marjorie Taylor Greene, representative from Georgia. What was her involvement?
Yeah, so this case kind of got on Bondi's radar through Marjorie Taylor Greene. As I mentioned, there was that rally, and I think that there was kind of a lot of social media about the case. And I think especially in conservative politics, this is being talked about quite a lot. And so the case got on Marjorie Taylor Greene's radar somehow, and she wrote a letter to Pam Bondi, essentially advocating for Dr. Moore, saying that he was a hero and that his case should be dismissed. And so that's kind of what set this into motion. And so you mentioned that photo shortly after the charges were dropped. Dr. Moore and his fiance went to DC, and they met with Pam Bondi and Marjorie Taylor Greene, and also Mike Lee was there. He had some role in this, but his office didn't respond as to what exactly he did. But Dr. Moore kind of went within a week from facing federal charges to being in a room with these like powerful politicians.
No, you interviewed Dr. Moore, right? He freely admits, the details in the case. Why does he say he did this?
Yeah, he talked to me for almost 2 hours, and he was very upfront about why he did what he did, and was upfront in saying that that's what he did. He agrees with what the government was alleging, that he did give out fake vaccine cards, he did throw away doses, he did give saline shots to children. All that stuff is true, he says. But he said that his motivation, as I mentioned earlier, was patient choice. He felt like with the mandates that were going on at that time, that he wanted his patients to be able to choose to not be vaccinated, but not be limited by some of those mandates that were in place. And he also emphasized that he didn't make any money off of this too, which I think is important to note because there were other healthcare workers in other places that were maybe like more selling the cards to make money, and that's not what he was doing. He didn't personally financially benefit from it.
I think you could say Dr. Moore is part of the medical freedom movement. Tell me more about that, broadly speaking.
Yeah, I mean the medical freedom movement kind of emphasizes personal choice over the collective well-being. I think the best example of that is with vaccines, not just COVID-19, but any vaccine. Obviously vaccines work if we have herd immunity, if enough people get vaccinated. And so for them, they want to be able to make that their own personal choice around vaccines based off of their own research and consider less perhaps the community well-being of a community being vaccinated. So that's kind of how the medical freedom movement believes or what they kind of ascribe to, and what we probably everyone has kind of seen recently is this movement really has been gaining a lot of momentum, especially with people like vaccine skeptic Robert Kennedy Jr. in this really high position in the Health Human Services. It's really kind of become more mainstream in this Trump administration.
So, I guess medical freedom, no mandates, right? Personal choice between a person and their doctor. But Dr. Moore, and I think probably others in the medical freedom movement, seems to go beyond that. Dr. Moore, as you noted in your story, kept calling vaccines bioweapons. Is that what he called them?
Yes, yeah, that's right.
So, is he referring just to COVID vaccine or a broad range of vaccines?
Yeah, that was his opinion about the COVID-19 vaccine. And he doesn't really agree with any vaccine. He said he believes that they're all poison, and he said that that's something that he has an opinion he's had for the last 20 years. I didn't ask him specifically about his vaccination status, but that's what how he believes now about vaccines generally.
Vaccines generally, yeah. And as you mentioned, now the official, I guess, stance of HHS and CDC is moving more to toward his side, right? With RFK Jr. in there and putting his people in there. Obviously, groups like American Medical Association and other professional medical groups have a very different view. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I talked with a lot of experts, and I think that there were people who had opinions just about what Dr. Moore or other healthcare workers who like similarly gave out fake vaccine cards, that one that was an unethical choice for a medical professional to make. But some of them say that medical professionals especially have kind of a duty to the community to help build trust in the system, the healthcare system, and when they are lying on records, that builds only distrust. And in the case where if an outbreak happened and we can't be confident in the vaccine records being accurate, that could spread a disease further. That there's a lot of issues that could happen, these experts say, if people aren't upfront about their participation or not participating in a vaccine program.
You mentioned expert, and that's become a controversial word, in the last few years, right? A movement, anti-expert movement. I guess if you're in the medical freedom movement, you're supposed to do your own research and come to your own conclusion.
I think that's one. I think they do ascribe to that kind of the idea of, doing your own research online. I know, one thing that Dr. Moore told me is he kind of doesn't believe it in disinformation, that there's only information, and people can kind of decide what they want. And so I think that's probably, I'm sure a lot of people in the medical freedom movement have similar outlooks. So of course, as you mentioned, some of the people who are experts or who are scientists who've been studying this, that obviously frustrates them when they're using science to kind of give recommendations.
You mentioned here, and I think some people scratch their heads. People like Dr. Moore don't trust the COVID vaccine that those in a class called mRNA, right? And you note in your story that science has been developing this technology for years. In fact, some of the scientists won the 2023 Nobel Prize in Medicine for this. But I guess the final development was fast, right? Mm-hmm. Operation Warp Speed, which President Trump touted for a while until he stopped touting it. Tell me about that a little bit.
Right, exactly. I mean, you pretty much explained it. I think one of the things that Dr. Moore and a lot of people who distrust or have questions or skeptical about the COVID-19 vaccine, they kind of point to the fact that it was developed very fast, which it was. But as you mentioned, it kind of came on the backbone of a lot of other research that's been going on. And so it wasn't as if, you know, they started from step one when the outbreak happened. They had all of this scientific work to build on. So that kind of just explains, as you said, like how this could happen so quickly, but why, you know, government agencies, healthcare officials, things like that have put their trust behind the vaccine.
One specific data point you mentioned in the story is disputed, I believe. Dr. Morris said his assertion that those vaccines, mRNA vaccines, failed in every animal test. What is, I guess, the FDA and others have come out and disputed that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the FDA, I believe, told reporters at that time, you know, around 2021, when the vaccine was coming out, that was not true. That was something that the FDA has come out and said, basically debunked it.
So tell me about, there are other folks that you quote in the story who did similar things to what Dr. Moore did and were charged. I guess they're taking hope from his case.
Yeah, you know, we found that Dr. Moore wasn't the only healthcare worker in the U.S. to give out fake vaccine cards and then face criminal charges for it. We found 11 other cases filed both in federal court and in some state courts with essentially the same fact pattern. And I found this group. They have an account on X called Covicted Patriots, and they are a group of people who gave out fake vaccine cards and were charged. They took plea deals, so they're convicted now. And they look at the outcome in Dr. Moore's case, this legal victory, and it gives them a lot of hope. And they want to, you know, maybe ask the president for a pardon or do something to kind of get restored justice in their own case. Because they, you know, at the time that they pleaded guilty, maybe wasn't when Trump was back in office. And so now that that has shifted and things are changing, the outcome in Dr. Moore's case, I think, ignites them in thinking, maybe I could get a change of course here. Maybe I could get a pardon or something like that.
Anything else you'd like to say about this story?
No, I think we pretty much covered it.
All right. I just have a couple minutes here. I'd like to treat at least briefly this story. Here's the headline. A Utah prosecutor's relative was there when Charlie Kirk was shot. Tyler Robinson's attorneys want his office kicked off the criminal case. Tell me very briefly about this.
Yeah, so this was a motion that was filed under seal initially, but it was just released last night. And essentially, the defense attorneys for Tyler Robinson, who was accused in shooting Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University, they are saying that there is a member of the prosecution team who had a family member who was at UVU when that shooting happened. And the filing is redacted, so we don't know who that prosecutor is or what that family relationship is. But the defense attorneys are essentially arguing that this creates a conflict and that this prosecutor shouldn't be allowed to take on the case, and that the entire Utah County Attorney's Office should be kicked off the case because this person, you know, has been involved in the prosecution so far. He has a supervisor role in the office. He was with the county attorney, Jeff Gray, when the shooting happened and was like reading the text messages from his family member to the county attorney. And so the defense attorneys essentially are saying that all of this just shows not necessarily a bias, but that, you know, it could affect his ability to prosecute the case fairly.
So Robinson is obviously facing multiple charges, including aggravated murder, I believe.
Yep, he's facing a lot of charges, aggravated murder, and he is facing the death penalty. The prosecutors did say that they're planning to seek execution in the case.
I'm sure you'll be following this one as well. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune investigative reporter Jessica Streifels. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.